All right, we are ready for Exodus chapters 19 to 21. And this is the outline that we're following. We're beginning a new section. We've looked at the Exodus, and now we're looking at the law, starting at 19 and 20, and then we'll through 24, and then we will look at the commandments, the judgments, and the ordinances. There's not a big difference in those terms. We'll get to those not tonight, but in other studies, what the variation of those terms of commandment, judgment, and ordinances. But we're looking at the substance of the law, the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Then we get into the tabernacle at chapter 25. So we're starting the second section, as per this outline, focused on the law. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1. Israel suffers in Egypt. Chapter 2, Moses' birth and early life. Chapter 3, all right, yeah, the call of Moses to deliver the people of God. And when he was asked, what did he do? Made excuses. Chapter 4, chapter 5, yeah, when he made the request to Pharaoh, he just increased the sufferings. Chapter 6, something Moses and Israel needs. Assurance. God gives them assurance. Starting with chapter 7, we have the plagues. So we have Aaron's rod in the first plague. So chapter 2 was 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Chapter 9, 5th, 6th, and 7th. Chapter 10, 8th, and 9th. Chapter 11 is not the 10th plague, but the announcement of the 10th plague. All right, chapter 12, the 10th plague itself, the Passover and the 10th plague. Chapter 13, yeah, the firstborn sanctified and the feast of the unleavened bread. Chapter 14 was the actual crossing of the Red Sea. This is the Exodus. Chapter 15, song of deliverance. Chapter 16, last time, yeah, manna come from heaven, manna and quail. Chapter 17, yeah, that's water from the rock, and there was the war with the Amalekites. And then 18, Jethro's advice, very good. Jethro's advice to Moses because he was overwhelmed. All right, we're ready for chapter 19. Chapter 19, I call simply at Mount Sinai in preparation to receive the law. Three things happen in this chapter. We have them arriving at Sinai in the third month. We'll give some description of whether that means actual 3 months have passed. I think not. We'll get to that in a moment. And where they arrive. And then here is the instruction that God gives through Moses to the people to get them ready to receive the law. And the Lord then makes his presence known. So chapter 19, they get to Sinai and they're getting ready for the law. The law starts in chapter 19, or chapter 20. Make sense? All right, so let's talk about them arriving at Sinai in the third month. In the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt. Someone asked after the class last time, how much time has passed since they came out of Egypt? And the focal point was on, look at the amount of complaining and griping that the children of Israel have already done. You've left us out here in the wilderness to die. Have they been out there for a year? Have they been out there for 6 months, 8 months? And they've only been out there less than 3 months. The time that's mentioned here, when the phrase, the same day, I take it as the English Standard renders this, was on the first day of the new moon. So rather than verse 1 simply telling us that this was the third month, in other words, three 30-day periods had passed. This is the beginning of the third month. The Exodus took place on the 14th day of the first month, so it's really been about a month and a half. Does that make sense? So as you go back to the Exodus in chapter 14, in the 14th day of the first month, and this, I take it a reference to the first of the third month, so it's only been about 45 days, some say as much as 50, some say a little as 40. It's a common conclusion among students of the text. So we're talking about less than two full months since they've come out of Egypt. They've made it to Sinai, but less than 2 full months, they've already made complaint to the Lord. Hadn't been out that long, and they're complaining and complaining and complaining. And we'll get to that a little bit more later. All right, let's talk about where they came. They came to the wilderness of Sinai, the text tells us at verse 1. For they departed from Rephidim and came to the desert of Sinai, and they camped there before the mountain. This is the traditional view of Sinai. Remember, we've talked about how some think Sinai is over here, and that this is also the land of Midian, and that Sinai is on this side of this gulf. But this is the traditional view, and we've traced them down, and they come from Rephidim on down to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. So we'll take it that that is the case. This is from Holman's Illustrated Bible Dictionary. This is the traditional site of what's thought to be Mount Sinai. Is it actually? I don't know. That's the traditional site. We'll come back to that mountain a little bit later. All right, let's start at verse 3 now. There are instructions that are given in verses 3 to 15 to the people, and we're going to learn a lot from this section. And so I want you to notice that, first of all, in verses 3 to 9, I can't read without a pencil in my hand, so I've got to have my pencil to read. I don't know why, but I've got to have a pencil in my hand to read. So watch me use it, and I'm not going to be writing with it. I don't know. I just got to read with a pencil. Anyway, starting at verse 3, that Moses went up to God, and God called him to the mountain. And so what's the point of verse 4? Yeah, you've seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I've borne you along, how I've taken care of you, like as he mentions here, on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Look what I've done for you. That ought to make them have the right attitude. It will not, but it should. Now, you might flag verse 5 and 6 because we see this concept in the New Testament. Same principle applies to us. That if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you will be a special treasure. You might underline that special treasure. For you will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. In other words, they're going to be a royal priestly race. Does God mention that concept at all in the New Testament, that we are a kingdom of priests? Yes. So you might make a marginal note if you don't have center reference columns or footnotes in your Bible, 1 Peter 2, verse 5, verse 9. And so when we get to 1 Peter, we'll think back to Exodus chapter 19. They were a kingdom of priests. And so there was a sense in which they were not the priest of the Levitical priesthood. All the people were not. But they all are priests in one sense of offering praise unto God. And so are we. But they are kingdoms of priests. They are a holy nation. And so God's point here is, you are a special treasure if you obey my voice. So what the people say, verse 8. Yeah, right. That's what they plan to do. Are they going to do it? Well, they have trouble in the wilderness. They have trouble once they get in the land. But they make the pledge, all that the Lord has spoken to us, we will do. So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. So I know what he brought back. Now I make a point about that because we're going to see something else at verse 9. And so the Lord said to Moses, behold, I come to you in a thick cloud that the people will hear when I speak to you and believe you forever. And so Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. Why that second time of emphasizing that phrase? It seems to be for emphasis. There was, as pulpit suggests, no fresh words for him to report to the Lord. At least not none recorded. And that seems to be a style of just emphasizing that he brought the words, he brought that message back to the Lord. The Lord already knew that, but he brought the Lord message back to the Lord. All right, now to start at verse 18. The people are not come near to touch the mountain, and this, we're going to learn some things here, very practical, I think. At verse 19, you might, verse 10, you might make underline the word sanctify, make a marginal reference to see verse 22, go over to 22, underline sanctify, and see verse 10. Tie those verses together. The people were to be sanctified, consecrated, in other words, your footnote will say, and so were the priests to be sanctified. And they were to sanctify them today and tomorrow, and then let them wash their clothes, and then be ready on the third day that God's coming down on the mountain. All right, here's what I'm learning from that. Their actions should demonstrate moral cleanness that is required to receive the law. Does that make sense? In other words, sanctify, consecrate yourself, and then wash your clothes. There's something special about to happen on the third day. You're going to come to the mountain. Moses is going to go up, but they're going to be at the foot of the mountain, but they can't touch the mountain. They can't get any closer than the barriers that are set up. And God's going to give the law, so get ready to receive the law. Here's what I'm learning from that. Not everybody prepares themselves to receive the law. They're not morally clean. They're not of a mindset to receive the law. They're not of the mindset to accept whatever God has said. They had pledged whatever the Lord's spoken, that's what we'll do. Okay, then get yourself ready and get yourself morally pure. That makes sense? All right. Set bounds around the law, and whoever touches it, what's going to happen to them? They're going to die. You can stone him and shoot him with an arrow. Verse 14, then Moses went down from the mountain and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. And then he said, be ready on the third day, do not come near your wives. In other words, abstain from intimate relationships. This is how important this was. Abstain from that during this three-day period, today, tomorrow, and on the third day, the Lord's coming down and the Lord's going to speak. Make sense? This was something special about to happen. Now then, beginning at verse 16, the Lord makes his presence known. So let's watch and flag some things of what happens on the mountain. Verse 16, what happens? In the morning on the third day, there was thunderings. All right, there's thunderings, there's lightning, a thick cloud, and the sound of a trumpet that was very loud and very long. Make sense? That's not all that happens. We're going to get the rest of it in a moment. So that all the people in the camp did what? Trembled. We're going to make a point about that in a moment. Let's go further. Then Moses brought the people, and they come to the foot of the mountain, and the mountain was filled with, here's something else, smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Then what else happened at the end of verse 18? Yeah, the mountains quaked. So here's what we have happening on the mountain. There was thunder, there was lightning, there was a thick cloud called darkness later in the context, the trumpet sound that was loud and long, and there was smoke and there was fire and there's an earthquake. What does all that suggest? Power, authority, say again, deity. Yeah, here's what I think is happening here. All of those answers are correct. That it is confirming that the law, it's confirming the law that's been being revealed by God. In other words, it's not that Moses goes up on the mountain, he's come back with some tablets of stone and said, this is the law God gave me. How do we know God gave it? Tell you how you know God gave it. There was thundering, there was lightning, a thick cloud, a trumpet sound, and then there was the smoke and the fire and the earthquake. That's how you know that came from God. Does that make sense? It confirmed what Moses received came from God. Tell you something else it does. It establishes the authority of Moses as a lawgiver. And at this point, the people recognize that. You say, how do you know? We're going to see that over in chapter 20 in just a few moments, beginning at verse 18 through 21. We'll come back to that later. Basically, they say, you be the mediator. We're not going to get close to God. We're not going to get approach God because we're so fearful. Make sense? So this is not just, if this were in play form, if we were watching, this is not just for a dramatic effect. God's sending a signal through that. This law was given by me, and this is my lawgiver that's bringing it to you. That's important. All right, let's go further. Look down at verse 21. Then the Lord said to Moses, come down and warn the people lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many of them perish. So go back down and tell them. not to come through, at, just like I've told you before. And also, sanctify, let the priests sanctify themselves, lest they break through. In other words, go back and emphasize, don't come any further, don't come any closer, don't get past the barriers, or they're going to die. And how did Moses react? Yeah, I've already told him that. Look at verse 23. That the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set boundaries. In other words, you don't need to tell them that again. He seems to be arguing against God, doesn't he, a little bit. You're telling me go tell them again. I don't see the need to tell them again. Because we've already told them and already set boundaries. They cannot come up. Footnote right here. The word cannot does not mean impossible, does it? Could they go beyond the barrier? Sure they could. Or why the warning, you're going to die? If it was impossible, why did God even need to warn them? They couldn't have tried it. They couldn't have done it if they tried. So sometimes the word cannot does not mean impossible. And you say, why is that important? We get to 1 John, the child of God cannot sin. That means it's impossible. It just means they should not. There are boundaries. Does that make sense to you? It's an important concept. All right, now verse 24, we learned something very practical here as we finish this section. The Lord said to him, what did he say? Get away from here. Away. Get down, and then you come up, you and Aaron. In other words, none of this talk about, you've already told them. I'm telling you to go tell them. You go tell them again. So here's something I learned from that. Don't argue with the Lord, especially questioning why he said something. Think we ever do that? Why did you say that? Why did you want us to give that requirement? Why did you want us to tell the people this? Or why did you repeat that again? Do we ever do that? In other words, why do we need to study, once we study Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Because it all says the same thing. So why can't we just study one of those books? Because the Lord gave us four. That's why. Don't question the Lord. Why 150 Psalms? They all have to do with praise to God. So why do I need to study all of them? Let's study about five of them. We got it. No, because God gave us 150. Don't question the Lord when he said repeat something. Does that make sense? God didn't think much about Moses questioning him. So Moses then went down and he spoke to the people. It took him a little time to learn that, but he goes back down and, okay, that's what God wants. That's what I'll do. I'll go tell him. Questions or comments on chapter 24 now? I mean chapter 24, chapter 19. They got to the mountain, and we have a great deal taking place, but Moses instructs him, don't come near, and the Lord makes his presence known. All right, so a lot of excitement going on at Mount Sinai. They've seen things like they've not seen before. They ought to remember the deliverance from Egypt. They forget about that. They ought to remember God taking care of them, bringing them manna, and water, and quail, and now this thundering and lightning. They've seen abundance of evidence for God, but they'll forget. All right, now let's talk about Exodus 20. What's in Exodus 20? 10 commandments. All right. We have the 10 commandments in 1 to 17, and then the people's reverence for God / request that Moses be to me their mediator. And then we have the law about the altar. Some very practical stuff here. All right, let's talk about the Ten Commandments in verses 1 to 17. The first four of these commandments deal with man's relationship to his God, such as have no other gods, no graven image, don't take the Lord's name in vain. We're coming back to all these. Remember the Sabbath day. The rest of those, the other six, 5 through 10, deal with his relationship to man. All right, so let's talk about the Ten Commandments. The first one, you shall have no other gods before me. What does that mean? And how did it apply to Israel? All right. Yeah, the Egyptians served many gods. And some of the Canaanites served many gods. And so they come out of Egypt, they're headed to Canaan, they come from a land, they're going to a land wherein people serve various gods. Sometimes they would serve this god and this god and this god. There were those who made the effort to serve the one true living God alongside of other gods. And perhaps they thought more of this God than they did their other gods, but they're trying to serve other gods. So God gives the prohibition at the start. You shall have no other gods. I'm the only one. Second prohibition, what was it? Do not have any graven or carved images or any likeness of something in the earth or under heaven or in the water. What does that mean? Yeah, whether it's something on earth, something that you think is in heaven, or something that's under the water, don't make this image. Not saying you can't make something to resemble something, but don't make any image that you might worship that. Sound like Catholicism? Yeah, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord, am a jealous God. And so, don't have any carved images. That doesn't mean you can't have pictures. That's one of the reasons, one of the passages cited by the Amish. If you've ever been around the Amish people, they don't want you taking a picture of them. Now, people do, but if you ask, can I take a picture of you with your buggy or whatever, and you and your children, no pictures. And they would cite this passage. That's not what this is talking about. Now, at verse 5, God said he was a jealous God and he would visit the iniquity to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. What does that mean? Consequences. He's not talking about the guilt of sin, but the consequences of sin. You might put a marginal note, chapter 34 and verse 7 is a parallel passage that deals with that same concept. Chapter 34, 7. If you want to jump over to 34, 7, flag chapter 20, verses 5 and 6. But it's interesting, God words this here, that those who would have these carved images are those who hate God. Doesn't mean they despise God, but they don't love him like they should. See how the term hate is used? Almost always. The term hate is used with reference to loving less. I'm not saying it always, but almost always. All right. In contrast, he'll show mercy to those who love him and keep his commandments. All right. Now let's look at the third commandment, and what is it? Don't take the Lord's name in vain. What does that mean? Yeah, disrespectful or dishonoring manner, very trivial, flippant use of the name of God, as we often hear in daily conversation, that trivial use of the name of God. Don't take it in vain. Don't defame the name of God. Number four, what's it? Sabbath day and keep it holy. No indication they had observed the Sabbath previous to this point, but here's the reason why. Why remember the Sabbath day? You can work 6 days, but on the seventh day you'll rest because God rested on the seventh day. Now, let's pause just for a moment and learn some practical things here. You might underline the 6 days you shall labor and do your work. Underline 6 days. I'm going to make a point that's going to be helpful to you as you talk to your children and grandchildren. Verse 11, underline 6 days and draw a line between them. The 6 days of their work week is parallel to the 6 days of creation. So if creation 6 days is millions of years, or six literal days separated by millions of years, the gap theory, then the work week for the Jews was to work millions of years and then rest. That ain't gonna work too well, is it? It was six literal days in their work week, then they rested on the seventh. That's parallel to the six literal days of creation. Make sense? We see the same thing in Exodus 31. Now, at verse 11, in the 6 days, God created, might circle these three words, heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them. Then he rested on the seventh day. So the idea is that God created some aspects through evolution, if you believe in theistic evolution, and then Millions of years later, he did a little more, and then he did a little more gradually. But in the 6 days, heaven and earth and sea and all that's in all of that, heaven and earth and sea, was created in those 6 days. All right, let's move on to the fifth commandment. What is it? All right. And if you honor father and mother, you may live long on the land. A couple of ways in which that's true. One is, obviously, if you obey parents, and because the same principle, by the way, is mentioned in Ephesians 6 with reference to us. So one way in which that's applicable is that if you listen to your parents and obey your parents, that is more conducive to longevity of life, number one. You're going to live the kind of life that's more conducive to that. You're not involved in the kind of things that bring brevity to life. It's not a guarantee you won't get killed. You may get killed young in a car wreck or whatever. But another way in this context is that a violation of that principle was punishable by death, Leviticus 19 and Leviticus 20. Those are two different chapters. That's not chapter and verse. Chapter 19 and chapter 20, punishable by death. So if you obey your parents, you're going to live long. If you don't, you may be killed. That is, you may be punished by death. Now, verse 12 also suggests, not only is that having to do with respect and obedience, but Mark 7 we saw, honoring your father and mother means you take care for them. Financial support for your parents when they are in need. All right, number 6 is what? Shall not kill. Does that mean all killing is murder? You should not murder, or you should not kill? No, because we're going to see later some were to be put to death. Number 7, you should not commit adultery. Number 8, you should not steal. 9, you should not bear false witness. And then 10, you should not covet anything of your neighbor's. What does it mean to covet? Yeah, an insatiable desire. In other words, I'm willing to go to whatever means to obtain that which belonged. For example, Ahab coveted Naboth's vineyard to the point he's willing to go whatever means to get it. That's covetousness. It doesn't mean, I think, that you see your neighbor have something and you offer to buy it. You covet, you wanted it, so you offer to buy it. That's not what he's talking about. But it's the idea of this insatiable desire that is satisfied at any expense. All right, we're familiar with the Ten Commandments, so we're going to leave those. Let's go to the people's reverence, 18 to 21, see what happens here. When the thundering and the lightning and the flashing and the sound of the trumpet and the smoke, etc., the people trembled and stood afar off. They're afraid. Now, verse 19, they said to Moses, what? You speak with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak to us, lest we die. Two things I've learned from that. They are viewing God. That's not that they don't like God. It's they think God is so awesome and so mighty and so powerful, we cannot stand for him to talk to us. You deal with God, and then you come and talk to us. It's a reverence for God, a fear of God. And we're going to see fear here in the context. But here's the second thing I learned from that. Moses was just asked to be their mediator. He's going to be the mediator. But they ask him, you be the go-between between us and God. Does that make sense? Some label this in their outline, 18 to 21, Moses becomes mediator. I think it focuses more on their reverence for God. But anyway, verse 20, Moses said, do not fear, don't be afraid, for God has come to test you, that his fear may be before you, so that you might not sin. I learned two things from that verse. Number one, I'm learning the fear, I think, in the term fear is used in more than one sense. Primarily has to do with either being afraid of God, and I think that's what he means, do not fear, that his fear may be before you, having to do with the awe of God. How do I know that? That's what he just talked about at verse 19, when they said, we stand in awe of God, basically. God has come that his fear may be before you, so that you might not sin. In other words, you keep these Ten Commandments. Does that make sense? Fear of God drives us to do the will of God. Powerful verse at verse 20. You'll hear it cited many times. Now, the thick darkness, the term darkness is used, hadn't seen that before. The cloud is pictured as darkness here for what it may be worth to you. Now, let's talk about the law of the altar. Starting at verse 22 now, You might set this section off or make a marginal note. Chapter 20, verse 22, through the end of 23, which is verse 33. So we'll give that again. Starting here at verse 22, through the end of chapter 23, is a section of laws of about 70 laws we're going to go through, depending on how you count that. When we get into some of the ramifications about this ox goring you, if it, this happens and this, do you count that as three different laws or is that one law? So about 70, some have counted, and you can count, and you say, well, I didn't get but 50, or you may have got 95. I don't know. I don't care. But I'm just saying there's a bunch of laws. I am correct in saying that, I know. So what do we have here in verse 22 and 23? God's repeating himself. Yeah, he's already told them that. And so we're learning from what he told Moses. I'll repeat my, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm going to repeat myself when I want to repeat myself, and don't you worry about it. And so he reminds them, do not have any gods of silver or gold or anything else. Don't make anything beside me. Now, you're going to make an altar. What did he say about the altar? When you're going to offer a sacrifice to me, I want it to be made either of earth or of stone. Yeah. Now, what about the stone? Wouldn't it be better to, let's get hewn stone and make it real decorative, make it real beautiful and pretty? What did he say about that? Yeah, don't defile it with a tool. In other words, any altar that's built of stone, I don't want it hewn stone. And the tool will defile the stone. Some have suggested that maybe perhaps the more beautiful they make the altar, it becomes an object of worship itself. And that's in, he mentions that right in the context, don't have any other gods of silver or gold, etc. Before me. And then he says, if you make one of stone, don't make any steps thereof. It looks like if we're going to make an altar to God, let's build this big old tall altar, and the priest then can go up, and why not? He'll expose his nakedness as he goes up, and that will be exposed. And that was inappropriate. So I'm learning from verse 25 and 26, God demands the best of our service. And I'm learning that respect for the worship of God is important. Don't do anything so that you expose your nakedness in offering the worship and service unto God. Make sense? All right, that's the Ten Commandments. God's are the people's reverence for God. And now we have in chapter 21. Now this sounds a little more like Leviticus. And this is what I'm about to say is not disrespectful toward the law, but as we get to Leviticus, we're going to do our best to make it as interesting as possible. But teaching Leviticus is like teaching a phone book. That's just a fact of the matter. You have law after law after law after law that is very important. And this section here, chapter 21, is somewhat like that. But there's some practical things that we're going to try to learn from that. And that's going to be helpful because we're going to come to some quotations from chapter 21, and we're going to wonder, what was that about? So making a flag or a note right here is going to be helpful. All right, let's talk about the servants. Now, here's something we don't talk a lot about. All through the Old Testament, and even in New Testament times, there were slaves and there were servants. And there's indication here that there would be Hebrews who had Hebrew servants or slaves. Do you see that? And in the New Testament times, there would be slaves sometimes owned by brethren. And so what about the issue of slavery? I'm not going to get into that, but eventually the New Testament principles obliterates that. Not by a prohibition, but the principles of treating one another fairly and treating one another right just kind of washes it out before it's over. Does that make sense? You follow the New Testament principles and there is no such thing as slavery. So anyway, let's talk about the servants. These are the judgments that I set before you. If a Hebrew servant, and so how did he get to be a servant in the first place? Well, sometimes through poverty, they sold themselves. You could sell yourself into slavery because you're in such need that I'll sell myself to you if you'll take care of me and feed me and house me, etc. And so I'll be your servant because you're going to take care of me and my family as my family grows. All right, we see that in Leviticus a little bit later, but we're not going to go there now. What if a Hebrew has a servant? What's he going to do with him? All right, well, I'm coming back to that. I just wanted the first part. He serves for 6 years, and then he lets him go free. That's the law. Now, there are some qualifications of that. That's where, are we talking about another law, or are we talking about the manifest explanation of that same law? But he's to let him go free. All right. Then, as Diane just said, if he comes in by himself, he goes out by himself. If he comes in married, he leaves on the seventh year married. But if he comes in and he's given a wife by his master, now things turn different. He's got a choice. What's his choice? Yeah. Yeah, he can leave, and he has to leave his wife behind because it belongs to his master. Or he can decide, I'm going to love my master, verse 5, and he's going to serve him forever. So verse 6 says they go to the judges. Now, I think these perhaps are the same judges we saw in chapter 18 that Jethro suggested they appoint. We're going to see them at verse 22. Let's get ahead of ourselves. Circle the word judges. You're going to need to know about those judges before we're through tonight and through the rest of the Old Testament. And in New Testament, there's some references we'll talk about. Something was done by the judges. This is who we're talking about. Not the judges of the book of Judges, these judges. And so the master would take him through this ceremony, put an awl through his ear, and in other words, symbolize, and the ceremony says, you're my servant forever. So basic laws concerning servitude. All right. Now there's something else. Verse 7. A man sells his daughter to be a maidservant. She shall not go out as the men servants do. In other words, she's not released at the end of 6 years in the seventh year. Now, why is that? We don't know for sure. Some have speculated that perhaps it was for her protection, that she would not be left without provision, that she stays because she's at least provided for there. If she's put out, she's left without protection. Maybe. I don't know. But if she does please her master and he's the one that took her, I'm paraphrasing verse 8, he took her in thinking he's going to marry her. Now what? And he decides he doesn't want her anymore. He can have her put up for sale, basically. She can be redeemed, bought back, but she can't sell her to a foreign nation. Can't sell her away from here. But if he had taken her to be betrothed to his son, and he deals that away with her, let him deal according to the custom of the daughters. In other words, he's to treat her as a daughter. Now we get to a little more questionable language. If he takes another wife, that's polygamy, didn't mean God approved of it, but God did tolerate that. He shall not diminish three things. What are they? Food, clothing, and marriage rights. Now, what is marriage rights? Some, such as Bible Knowledge Commentary, suggest that probably refers to living quarters. But I take it as Pulpit and Colin Daitlich, which I lean on more than I do some of the others, that probably had to do with conjugal rights. And so he was still to see that those were provided to her and for her. And if he doesn't do that, then she's released and nothing has to be paid. He just lost his servant. Does that make sense? Laws of servitude right here. All right. Now, the Bible talks about we're servants. We're servants of Satan or servants of God. And so the New Testament is going to borrow on that language of servitude that goes all the way through New Testament times. All right, that gets us through verse 11. Now, verse 12 to 27 talks about various acts of violence. And so the first one is, in 12 to 14, murder. If a man strikes another man so that he would surely die, what's going to happen to him? He's going to be put to death. We call that today capital punishment. This is not the beginning of that. Where do we see that begin, that principle? We need to be familiar with this. Not here. Didn't start with Moses. Didn't start with Abraham. All right, yeah. Genesis 9 and verse 6. Yeah, murder was right there. That was the first case of murder. Genesis 9 and verse 6, then we see that man is made in the image of God, and whoever shed man's blood by man's blood, shall his blood be shed, was Genesis 9, 6. So God instituted capital punishment way back on Genesis 9 and verse 6 for what that may be worth to us. Now, verse 13, but if he doesn't lie in wait, in other words, it's not premeditated, and God deliver him into his hand. Kind of strange wording. I don't take that God actually delivers one into the hand and then he kills him. God's not going to call that premeditated murder, but I think most seem to think that means that if he by chance comes upon his enemy and he kills him, it wasn't premeditated, then I will appoint him a place to flee. Now, that's not mentioned here, but that most likely refers to the cities of refuge. We come to that later in the Old Testament. But probably refers to the cities of refuge. But if a man premeditates, in other words, first degree murder, verse 14, you're going to kill him even if he's doing what? Holding on to the... you shall take him from my altar that he may die. In other words, why is he going to the altar? Probably pleading for mercy. But he's committed first degree murder. You're going to execute him even though he's pleading for mercy. Does that make sense? He's at the altar pleading for mercy. All right. Now let's talk about the verse 15 and 17. I skipped verse 16 on purpose. The matter of curse, if he strikes father and mother and puts them to death, or if he curses father and mother, in other words, the same principle of blasphemy against his parents, he's to be put to death. God had a number of cases. What about the man who kidnaps? Or the person that's been kidnapped is found in his hand. He is to be put to death. 18 and 19, let's quickly get that. What if two men are fighting and one of them hits the other one so that he dies, does not die, but he's confined to his bed and he rises up and he's able to walk again. What's he going to do? Pay the damages, pay what he missed, but he's not going to be put to death. Same principle found at verse 19. So let's jump on to verse 20. If a man beats his servant, though, and I take that's probably in the context of the servant being disrespectful, the servant being, I don't think it's just arbitrarily beating him, but if you beat him and he doesn't die, and he's able to live for 2 or 3 days, then what? He's not going to be punished. For that, but only provide for the loss of time. Now, I've got the wrong verse there. Verse 21, notwithstanding he remains alive a day or two, he should not be punished for in other words, he just lost his property. Now then, we get to some interesting things here. I'm going to see if I can get through as much of this as I can. If you injure a pregnant woman, and she gives birth prematurely, whatever her husband suggests and the judges agree to, I had you to circle the word judges. We're going to make a point about those judges here in a second. Then that's what's to be determined. So the judges had a lot to do with determining the judgment. But if lasting harm comes, then you shall give life for life. And now notice verse 24. We've got to talk about this if we don't get anything else. Eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. The reason I had you underline or circle the word judges is that execution of eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is to be administered by the judges. So that was not a statement as was interpreted by some of the rabbis, Matthew 5. Remember that? You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The rabbis interpreted that as a get even principle. But what this was doing was ensuring the punishment met the crime. And that was determined by the judges. Make sense? So it's not that if someone knocked your eye out, you go knock their eye out. You didn't have a right to do that. The judges were to do that. They were to execute that judgment, making sure that you don't take a man's eye out because he happened to take your finger off. You deal with them and mete out the punishment to fit the crime. Does that make sense? And executed by what do we circle? Judges. We need to know that as we come later to Matthew 5. All right. Now, let's jump on to the bodily injury to I want to skip that, and I want to go to the animal control. If your ox gores another person, what do we learn from this section? The ox should be stoned, and he's acquitted, the owner. But what if he tended to do that and he'd been told, your ox is out goring people, trying to kill people, and he doesn't do anything about it? Then what happens? He's to be put to death. He bore some responsibility. All right, the same principle of the loss of the animal through negligence of the property owner. We see that in 33 to 34. And I'm going to skip on down to finally get verse, because our time is gone, 35 and 36. If you lose an ox fighting another ox and you lose that, then here are the rules and regulations concerning that. Now, you won't remember all of that come morning. But the point is, God had details of the law laid out. We see more of that in Leviticus. Make sense? We're going to see a little more of that through chapter 23. And then we get back to some narrative of the history of what goes on. We need to stop right there. Time is gone.